and welcome to After Dark with Rob and Andrew on America Out Loud Radio Network, available on iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, or just about any audio app. We have a very important show for you tonight, but first off, let me go to my co-host, Rob. How are you doing so far tonight?
I'm doing good, Andrew. Thank you for asking. I made it here tonight to be with our audience, and I hope that they are ready to listen and receive the message that we're going to give them tonight. Tonight is a very special show because we have on the show with us Pastor Sam Jones. Pastor Jones is the author of the book, 5 Steps to Kill a Nation and How to Stop the Bleeding. Now, I've looked through the book, and I got to tell you, some of the things that he's pointing out are so right on point. Because in today's society, I think one of the things that we're missing is spirituality. We're missing a relationship with God. We're missing a relationship with an all-powerful being. Now, some people would push back on that and say, no, we don't want to bring anything religious into it. Well, that's the problem, Andrew, because I think if we got back to the basics, and if people really understood, stopped and listened and connected, we wouldn't be where we are today. But for some reason, there is this push that people want it out. They want it out of the schools. They want it out of society, out of Sunday school that I went to every Sunday when I was a kid. It shaped me. It formed me. It gave me a foundation. And I'm appreciative of it. Now, I will admit, I didn't always like going to church, but it was a foundation that it gave me, a core values of treating people with respect, treating people right, not being so quick to anger. I like that. Now, some would say, I can get that without going to church. Well, maybe so. But I think that's the beginning. So I'm excited to have Pastor Sam Jones on with us, the pastor of Faith Baptist Church in Ohio. Pastor, how is it going?
Oh, it's going great. Thank you for having me on here, Rob and Andrew. Just real excited to be here tonight with you guys.
Tell us a little bit about that and what led you to write this book.
Yeah, 5 Steps to Kill a Nation. What really led me to write this was I was kind of looking around at our nation and just seeing things fall apart. And I actually started writing this well before COVID hit and the pandemic hit, but things definitely sped up during that time. But that wasn't what was drawing me into writing. A lot of people have mentioned that maybe that was the reason why, but that's not what it is. I was seeing this around, looking at just the moral fiber of our nation decaying, but also just what the pillars of our society were absolutely decaying. And I started thinking about it one day and I was going, what in the world, what is causing this? You know, if we want to fix this, we have to get back to the root problem and correct it at its foundation, because it's not just a little spot that we've gone off, a little warp or something like that, but it's actually a foundational issue, I believe, in our nation. And when I started thinking about that, I started thinking about the foundations of Western civilization as a whole. And a lot of people would say that's the bringing together of Jerusalem and Athens. And we talk a lot about Athens and the great philosophers and things like that. But what we don't talk a lot about is Jerusalem and that idea of the Ten Commandments. And it is called 5 Steps to Kill a Nation. I combined some of the Ten Commandments into some even more generalized principles. But for the most part, the book, I go through the Ten Commandments. And when you abandon the Ten Commandments, ultimately, you do destroy a nation. And I believe that's because the God of the Bible is the God of nature also. And so when you go against him, you're going to go against not just his laws that are written, but also inherently you're going to go against his natural laws. And so when you go against natural laws, you lose this sense of reality. And when you're not in reality, you start living in a delusion. And that's really where our nation has been living, is in moral delusion and really economic delusion right now, and all kinds of other delusions also. And it's really led us onto a downward spiral that has really started to destroy and to even kill our nation. But fortunately, I do think there is a way back. We can stop the bleeding.
Why do you think that society has just like abandoned those principles of religion?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things is that nature abhors a vacuum. And as we consider that idea that nature abhors a vacuum, and there came this idea through Nietzsche and others that God is dead, and then was embraced a lot through Darwinism and in different ideas like that and in different philosophies. And then we see it kind of go mainstream in the early 1900s, probably 1930s, somewhere in that range in the United States. And when they try to remove God from things like the school, even we see in more recent history, God from marriage and different areas of life, we see that nature abhors that vacuum. And so that something must replace it. And in reality, our nation isn't necessarily just removing God from everything, because inherently something has to take that place. And what's really taking the place is secular humanism. And if we were to go and to read the Humanist Manifesto number 2 and to go through the different points, we'd be amazed to see how much it lines up with our nation today. And it was written almost prophetically in I believe it is 1973 when it was written. And what it is that we've replaced the God of the Bible for a different God. And that's the God of your truth or whatever it is instead of objective truth, subjective truth. And that is the humanist God. We have put ourselves as God instead of recognizing the God of the Bible.
So walk us through the 5 steps to kill a nation and then how to stop the bleeding.
Okay, so the 5 steps to kill a nation, the first one is really interesting. It's forgetting God, and this is incredibly foundational. And we see this warned, our founding fathers warned us not to forget God, not to forget these foundations. But we see this, as I mentioned before, in taking God out of school, Bible and prayer, prayer out of school, and different things like that. It's interesting because if you actually look at the public schools, we've got people in our church right now who have their children in public schools, and they come to me almost weekly saying, you know, there's a different religion that's being pushed. So it's not really removing religion from schools, but specifically removing Christianity. We moved away from the New England Primer, the Blue Back Speller, things like that, that are very centric to and founded on God's word. And we've forgotten God in our society. And one of the hallmarks, or really the hallmark of Western civilization, is that we believe in a monotheistic God. So there's one God, and that means that there's one ethical standard, which then gave our nation in Western civilization a unity to move forward for similar goals. And that has really been the foundation for the United States to spring forward and to go forward in success. And we've removed that one monotheistic God for humanism, which is essentially setting each and every person as their own God. And so we've forgotten God, set each one as their own God, and then we have all these different ethical standards. And if one of the main things in chapter 1 that I think is interesting, even as I reflect on it, is that we've replaced our ethics with entertainment today. And so step 1 is this idea of forgetting God. And I think we've done that a lot, not just through removing him from different areas of society, but also we've done it through amusement of not thinking. Amusement means it's A, no, and muse, thinking. So no thinking. And we've amused ourselves so much that we've quit thinking and we've removed God from our society. And that's given us different ethical standards as we've gone to this model of entertainment as opposed to ethics.
So many of our young people, they're so quick to glorify and uplift entertainers, and they're worshiping of them in their praise and wanting to be like them, which is so unattainable. But in their minds, they think that they can do it. So we see the pictures of these entertainers on billboards and all over. Even as little kids, the entertainers are like on Sesame Street and all these children programs. So they're indoctrinated at an early stage. They're building that fan base. So that by the time these kids are teenagers, they're completely sold on these entertainers and know nothing about God. Nothing at all.
Absolutely. And even as it goes into politics, looking at that, and I think it's really impossible to separate faith from politics because it all comes from our worldview as to what we would make those decisions on. But we think about that in today's day and age, some of the biggest political activists and movers are those entertainers that we think about, whether it's sports heroes or whether it's actors and actresses. It really does get into that, and they're driving a lot of people into their ideology. And a lot of times if we stop and we think about it, why would we think that somebody who's good with the basketball, and I mean, I love basketball, but, and it doesn't mean that they're going to be bad at politics or something like that necessarily, but, just because they have a platform with a lot of people looking at them, that they're doing something with the basketball or they're acting on screen, why would we think that that really gives, them the secret sauce is to actually test their ideas, not just look at the popularity contest, but it really has become much more of a popularity contest as opposed to a thinking endeavor. But the other steps to kill a nation, the second one, and they all build on that first step to kill a nation, but the second one is to destroy the family. And this is absolutely important because we think about one of the biggest issues in our nation today is that instead of a bottom-up government, one that is by, for, and of the people, where the people are essentially king in our land, we've really become a federal government of a federal beast, where the federal government has much more power than anything else, any of the other governments. And one of the reasons for that is because we have weakened families. And when you have weakened families, you're going to have weakened communities. Where you have weakened communities, you're going to have weakened cities. And where you have weakened cities, you're going to have weakened counties. And where you have weakened counties, you're going to have weakened states. And then we have weakened states. Well, once again, the power goes to the federal government. And so it's become top heavy, which isn't what our nation was designed as. But how we've destroyed the family, of course, the two commandments that go with this are our children obey your parents. And the second one is thou shalt not commit adultery. And we've done this through sexual perversion, which has come into our nation just incredibly high rates and dissolving that family unit. And then when you do that, you don't have a sense of commitment and stability. And why that's important is because the family unit is what God designed to pass on morality. We could see that clear in Genesis, even in the Levitical law, but we can also see it even in 2 Timothy, where the Apostle Paul goes and tells Timothy that his genuine faith was passed down, not necessarily physically through genetics, but passed down through example from his mother and his grandmother. But when we have weakened families, we see that those ethics aren't passed down. And really, we do see the state stepping in right now and trying to remove children from the families and put them a lot more in public schools and a very much so an overreach often on families even. And why are they doing that? Well, it's because they're trying to instill a different set of ethics. And ultimately, a different set of ethics is going to lead to a different government and a different worldview.
Now, would you also say that families, they no longer eat together? They no longer have the morning breakfast or dinner. And when that time is taken away, when you're unable to come together as a unit, as they say, the family that prays together stays together. Well, we're not having that morning prayer before breakfast or the evening prayer before dinner time. So we're unable to inquire as to what the other person is doing. So little by little, the family tradition is just chipped away and it's replaced with something completely different. It's replaced with the friend's hour. I want to go to my friend's place. And not just that, but the basic fundamental setup of the family, what we consider as being a family, has changed. It's changed so drastically that institution is almost non-existent. And when you do see it, it makes you smile, but it's almost gone. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, something you said there, Rob, just really, really hit me to the heart because it reminded me of something. And that was that families don't sit down and eat together. And my wife and I were foster parents. And the first foster child we had, he came to our house and I still remember it. He was a young child but he didn't know how to sit at a table. And we thought this was a little bit strange because culturally, both me and my wife, we grew up in a family unit that each one of us that you know, ate together and sat at a table. But we inquired of the social worker, you know, why, you know, we kind of listed this concern. And she said, well, no, he doesn't know how to sit down at a table because they don't have one at his biological parents' house. And that just, you know, really hit us. But that became, and we only had him in our house for about 2 months. But in those 2 months, that became one of his favorite times, was sitting down at the table to eat with us. But you're absolutely right. There isn't that camaraderie anymore. And that really togetherness and that bond and that unity, because we have destroyed that family unit.
And it makes you wonder why so many people today, when we see kids that are out in the streets, why are they out in the streets? Well, they don't have a family to go to. That family isn't there. And like you said, this kid learned to love that quality time. It means so much when you're able to take a child and sit down with them and listen to them and to share your experiences with them. And that takes place during those hours when we're having breakfast. What are you going to do today? How is your day going to start? You're going to be successful today. And then in the evening hours, how was your day? What did you do today? What were some of the things that you encountered? If we were to bring that back so that kids could have those conversations with their parents, and not only the kids, but husbands and wives could have those conversations as to how your day went. It's all taken away. So that's so important, that part of your book, to destroy the family. And I think that there are forces out there that want to destroy the family, and they could care less because they don't like it, they don't have it. So to them, it's meaningless. But it helps keep our country together, to keep that family unit together by having that time together, having those bonds so that we could build on top of it.
Absolutely. That's how traditions are passed down. And I mean, just like you said, there are forces out there that are seeking to destroy it. I believe it's been removed from their website, but Black Lives Matter started off and enlisted pridefully on their website that their goal was to destroy the nuclear family. And also, you know, we even think of Hillary Clinton and her book, It Takes a Village, that idea, that mindset of moving away from the nuclear family unit and moving into this idea that it's society raising children as opposed to parents raising children. And it makes it so that you can't pass down traditions. You can't go and talk through the moral dilemmas of the day. You can't go and do the things that need to be done. And for the training and rearing of a child and what a child needs, that one-on-one or family unit, you know, smaller unit. I suppose if you got 30 kids, it's really not one-on-one, but it's one of those big ideas of going and talking through, just like you said, what was your day? What did you encounter today? Those kind of things of unpacking it and then talking through the decision-making process, that's being ripped out of our society today. And go for it, Rob.
Yeah. Well, just something else that you touched on that I definitely want to make a commentary. Black Lives Matter, like you said, that was on their website to destroy the nuclear family. So many people are oblivious to it. They're completely unaware of it. And I've mentioned to so many of my Black friends, are you aware that that's on their site? To destroy the family, to take the Black man out, to belittle the Black man. No, they know nothing about it. As far as they're concerned, BLM is a catchy phrase and they're down with it. I'm like, you need to know more than just running for a cause, because if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. And then another note that you mentioned, Hillary Clinton's It Takes a Village. Now, I have to admit, I fell for that. And I thought, wow, that's so true. Because I remember when I was growing up and you had the entire community, if you did something wrong, your neighbors were going to tell you. But little did I know, she meant something completely different. She meant that you as a parent can't control your child. You cannot set the boundaries. Other people have to set the boundaries. Now, how she was able to just ease that in there, and so many people were saying, oh yeah, it takes a village. No, she's not talking about that. She's talking about something completely different. So what you're saying right now, Pastor, I agree with you 100%. And we have to be aware, because those forces that are out there to destroy the family will succeed if we aren't careful. They will deceive the righteous.
Absolutely. And I can't, I couldn't agree with that or say it better than what you said, because it does sound really good what Hillary Clinton said, it takes a village, but she means something completely different. In both of these ideas too, forgetting God and destroying the family, it naturally leads to the third one, because when you don't have values in family, and you're not anchoring your ethics to a morality to God, ultimately you do then devalue life. And of course, we can see that most prevalently through abortion. And one of my, I'll say one of my heroes, Phil Haney, who passed away here in 2020, just before the pandemic hit. He was actually murdered. But I was listening to him one time, and he made something known that was incredibly impactful, and it just opened my eyes. And that was, we live in an abortion culture, and as we live in an abortion culture, we can see a lot of times those who would commit great heinous crimes, but we often can't see the victims. And that's of course completely true when it comes to abortion. We don't hear the voice of the preborn. We don't see the faces of the preborn. They can't stand up or speak for themselves. But we also see that creeping into other areas of our life. You know, we think of school shootings, which of course, school shootings are terrible. With that doesn't mean that we should be against guns. I think that guns are part of the solution, not necessarily part of the problem. It's people that are the problem, making bad decisions. But I can see, and I guess this isn't a school shooting, but I can see in my mind still to this day, the movie theater shooter there in Colorado for The Dark Knight, I can see his face. I can't see a single victim's face though today. We've moved on from that. It's become just so mundane that we just believe that it's a statistic when people die, and we've devalued life. And in our society, what we're about to find out is that the generation that chose to abort children are going to be the generation that are chosen to be euthanized by their grandchildren. And it's going to just be absolutely devastating, because we've devalued life and we've unanchored ourselves from God's ethics and morality there.
That's so powerful. The devalue of life, abortion. And we're making it such a commonplace that people don't even think about it. They don't even give it a second thought. It's as if though abortion on demand, the same way you go up to Walmart, not Walmart, but McDonald's or Chick-fil-A, and say, oh, I want to order a Big Mac. I want to order this. Well, I want an abortion. At one point, that was like something that we would hardly hear about. No one wanted to mention the big A word. But nowadays, it's like, oh, abortion, 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 abortion in all the different neighborhoods, especially Black neighborhoods.
Yeah, it goes back to step two as well, where a lot of these children can get abortions without their parents' permission.
And it's dangerous. It is extremely dangerous that a child can go in and have an abortion without their parents' permission. Again, just abortion on demand. And we think nothing of it. The devalue of life is if though life doesn't matter, we don't care about it. You got it. Let's just get rid of it and let's keep on moving on. And we see this in society, 2021. Never in a million years would I have thought that abortion would be on demand and we would talk about it so cavalier. So Pastor, I mean, I got to say, the forgetting God, destroying the family, the value of life, they all intertwine and they all connect together. Those first three steps that you just mentioned, because if you forget about God, you can care nothing about the family. And if you don't care about the family, if a person is pregnant, it's like, hey, I don't need a family. Let me get rid of it. And it's so unfortunate.
Absolutely. It is unfortunate. And then to connect the steps even further, the fourth step is taking what isn't yours. And of course, if you don't care about life and you don't care about the family and you've forgotten about God, you're going to take what isn't yours. You're going to steal. And in our nation, we have on the verge, and really it's really here right now. And that is systemic theft. We hear all these times in our nation about different systemic problems. Well, the biggest not the biggest, I'd say the big systemic problem is abortion right now, but the one of the biggest systemic problems is systemic theft, and that's called socialism, where there is a not a recognition of private property. The state believes it owns everything. And one of the statistics I cite in my book there in chapter four or step four is 70% of millennials say that they would be okay with socialism. And why is that a big deal? Well, millennials, a lot of times people think young people, you know, they're just the young people. Well, those young people, the millennials are voting now, and pretty soon they're going to be the largest voting bloc. I believe right now it's Gen X, but millennials are close on their heels. And so they're going to have the biggest voting power voting for socialism. Now, one thing I touch on in this is it doesn't work. Socialism doesn't work. And that's something that every conservative commentator comes at with, and it's correct. Socialism doesn't work. But where I go with it, and I think this is the more important point, and this is why we've lost the millennials and the younger generations, is that we need to first tell them that it's immoral. It's wrong to take money from someone else to redistribute wealth. And this is why I think it's important. Young people are generally not as pragmatic. They're generally more principled. And so when we try to reach the principled with pragmatism, what happens? They go and they say, well, that's nice, but I'm going to stick to my principled. And how has those who push socialism got it to come through? Well, they've said, well, don't you love the person next to you? Don't you love your neighbor? And of course, they go and they say, well, yeah, well, if you love your neighbor, don't you think that they should have more money? And by the way, you can have more money and free college and free this and free that too. Doesn't that sound good? And they're really, the young people, I believe, especially the ideologues, they're not getting reached with the idea of, hey, I just want free stuff. I really think they're getting reached by this idea of the principle of it, that they're making it sound so good from the other side, and we're forgetting to present the principle. But wait, money doesn't just come out of thin air. It comes from somewhere. Do you really think it's right to take from someone who's earned this money, or at least it's been earned somewhere down the line, and giving it to somebody who hasn't earned it? You know, that's called theft. And when we stop and we present it in those kind of terms, I think we can start to turn the tide and the shift with seeing millennials and the younger generations repudiate socialism. But we really need to get on that before it's too ingrained in their minds.
I agree, we need to get on it. But as I said earlier, it starts at such a young age with these kids going to school. And many of our schools aren't teaching our children the basics. They're not teaching them what you just said. They're teaching them something completely different. If you look at the curriculum that is being offered to a lot of the kids today, you know, this whole thing, what, you know, everyone should have the same thing. And if you can't make it, we're going to give it to you. It's all about giving, giving, giving. And of course, these young minds are thinking, if they grow up hearing this and seeing this, they will think, oh, okay, you know, I don't have to work hard to get, because it's going to be given to me. The government will give it to me. So I'll just keep taking and taking and taking, as opposed to giving back. And it's so dangerous, and it's so unfortunate, because the lesson to learn is, look at all the other countries that have tried this. Look at Venezuela, look at Cuba. They've all failed. But for some reason, it's not taught that in schools. It's taught that, well, the democracy that we have isn't good. Maybe it's not good. Maybe it's not the best, but it's better than the other countries. And look at the people that are coming here, because they want what we have. Why do you think they're coming here? Why do you think they're trying to get here and make a living? Look at all the other countries that are there that they could possibly go to, but yet and still, it is always America. Because they know, if I can get to America, I can make it. But our young people aren't taught to appreciate what they have and what they've been given. And it all goes back to, you know, forgetting God, the destruction of the family, destroy the family, and the devaluing of life, not having an appreciation for life. So if you don't have that, you're going to take what isn't yours and do whatever you want to do with it, because you don't care about your fellow man. You don't have the love in you for your fellow man.
Absolutely right, Rob. God just needs to be back in our nation, and we are learning so much with our guest, Pastor Samuel Jones. And you are listening to After Dark with Rob and Andrew on the iHeartRadio Network, Spotify, Stitcher, or just about any audio app. Check out the website, AmericaOutLoud.com, for tons of great articles and podcasts that will keep you busy for days. They just recently celebrated their 5th year anniversary and redid the website. You should go there and check it out. We will be back with more from guest Pastor Samuel Jones on pop culture, keeping the church together during COVID, and step 5 on 5 steps to kill a nation.
Hello, this is Lieutenant Randy Sutton, the host of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I am a 34-year police veteran. I am also the founder and CEO of an organization that stands behind injured and disabled law enforcement officers. It is called The Wounded Blue. Our website is thewoundedblue.org. We have produced a film. It is an important film. I urge you to watch it. The film details what happens when a police officer or law enforcement officer is shot or stabbed or beaten or disabled, seriously injured in the line of duty. Most people think they are taken care of medically and financially. The reality may be quite different. It is called The Wounded Blue: Service, Sacrifice, Betrayed. The film is available on Amazon, iTunes, and the Microsoft Store.
Today, America stands at the crossroads of history. Our actions will determine the fate of our nation. Well, that journey starts here and starts now. We invite you to join us in making the ultimate difference. Subscribe to our podcast and newsletters. Turn notifications on and stay in the know. You'll find all that back at AmericaOutLoud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
And we're back with Pastor Samuel Jones on America Out Loud, After Dark with Rob and Andrew. Now, before we went on break, Pastor Jones, we were talking about your book, 5 Steps to Kill a Nation and How to Stop the Bleeding. And we had covered forget God, destroy the family, devalue life, and take what isn't yours. And then the last one is to hate your neighbor. Now that's powerful because we're taught in the Bible to love our neighbors, but this, hate your neighbor. Explain to us what you mean by that.
Yeah, thank you, Rob. This is actually, I would say, my favorite chapter. In fact, I kind of plan on eventually writing an entire book with this concept, because if you go and you look at the other 10 commandments that I've gone over, of course, take what isn't yours is thou shalt not steal and thou shalt not covet. Devaluing life is thou shalt not kill. That's a pretty easy one. Destroy the family. Don't commit adultery. Or children, obey your parents, excuse me, on that one. And then and forgetting God is the first 4 commandments there. But what's left is do not bear false witness against your neighbor. And a lot of times people are wondering, how can you bridge that gap? In fact, when I was before I wrote this, I was telling the idea to some people, and I got some strange looks when I was bouncing off of some people. But then after they went and they read the chapter, they said that they understand. And what we've done in our society, and this is how we're hating our neighbor, is that we have really taken away truth, or at least objective truth, and we've moved towards subjective truth and subjective morality. And specifically, we've done this through what's called situational ethics. And this idea of situational ethics and subjective morality, subjective truth, ultimately it is lying against one another, or bearing false witness against one another. And that creates a hatred when we're not going and telling people the truth and we're not agreeing upon a truth or what truth is or what morality is. It leads to division and hatred. And as Jesus put it, how can a house divided stand? But this situation ethics here, it's interesting. It's not necessarily a super new idea ultimately, because I believe that Satan himself was the author of this when he looked at Eve and he said, "Did God really say?" in the Garden of Eden. But it was popularized and brought up for real, I guess, or systematized in 1966 by a guy named Joseph Fletcher, who was a seminary professor at Harvard Divinity School. And interestingly, just a few years later, he ends up going and becomes an atheist, and he still ends up teaching at this seminary even as an atheist. And he goes on to win two different Humanist of the Year awards, a Humanist of the Year, I guess I should say, and a Humanist Laureate. So he ends up really going and completely changing the perspective that he came from. But what was his whole idea with situation ethics? His whole idea was that you replace what we would call law ethics to love ethics. Now, how in the world do we get to hating your neighbor through love ethics? Well, the problem with love ethics is that love must be defined, or people can define it however they want. And we know that a sadist would define love much different than someone else. We know that that would cause a great problem. And we can justify just about doing anything with the idea of love. In fact, Joseph Fletcher, as cited in the book, goes and proclaims that abortion can be loving and different things of that nature, and even adultery could be loving. And so we find that really what he's promoting is this idea of an ethic of you can do whatever you want because you can choose your own morality. And this has been popularized, and we are trained even to just think this way because we become a who asker instead of a what asker when it comes to moral dilemmas. We ask who is going to be benefited from the decision I'm going to make, as opposed to what is right. And when we come to moral dilemmas, we really should be asking the question, what is right? And to give a biblical example of this, we could go to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego there in the book of Daniel. And they, of course, were told, along with the whole empire, to go and to bow down to worship this image. And they chose not to do that. But if they were situation ethicists, they could go and ask themselves or convince themselves that it would be most loving because all of their friends and their loved ones and their families would lose them if they didn't bow down, because they're going to get thrown into a fiery furnace and all for all they know, they're going to die. And they could go and say, you know what, it's just not worth it because I could be of so much more value to my friends, to my family, and everybody else. And they could be, even convince themselves that they're others focused. And so they could go and bow down, worship another god, and say, you know what, that's not really my god. I'm just doing it to kind of go along, to get along kind of a thing. And it's going to work out in the best in the long run. But that's not what they did. They asked what is right instead of thinking of who is to be helped. And of course, the real answer with this too is when we go to this law-based ethics or really God's word-based ethics, we end up coming to this realization that more people get helped because, of course, millions of people have been inspired by the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or Daniel in the lion's den would be another example of that. And we can go and see this all throughout Scripture. The other big thing about situation ethics is that it's very pragmatic based, and so it's seeking the idea of the ends justify the means. But the Bible would teach an ethic that the means are the only thing that can justify the means, in the sense of what John Quincy Adams said: "Duty is ours, results are God's." We're not concerned about the end results. We're concerned about doing what's right. And when we're not concerned about doing what's right, but we're concerned about those end results, we inherently hate our neighbor because we're all creating different ethical standards and creating a disunity then that we can't get behind. And ultimately, we're taking the truth away from our neighbor, whether it's from not telling them what is true when they need to hear what is true, or that idea of just wiping truth away from society as a whole.
Right. So, Pastor, why do you think that people are so afraid to speak the truth, to tell the truth, and they feel that they can do whatever they want to do, as if they're oblivious to the fact that your actions have consequences. In our society, it's as if though it doesn't matter, just do what you want and say what you want. Why have we gotten to that point?
Yeah, that's a good question. The first thing I would say is good branding. I mentioned it was 1966 that Joseph Fletcher wrote that book. Well, I believe it was 1967 that the All You Need Is Love came out. I just completely blanked on the name of that group. Was it the Beach Boys or was it the Beatles who sang that?
I don't even remember.
Yeah. But all You Need Is Love.
And so the Beatles.
The Beatles. Yeah. Thank you. It's good branding to go and love sounds so good and everything like that. And like I said, if you don't define love, then it essentially means that you can make it into your own image. And I believe that's what our society has been taught and what our society has been doing. And this has been perpetuated by the church. It's been perpetuated by society. But the other side of it is too, is, you know, we're a very prideful nation in the good sense of pride. We have some of that, but also we have the bad sense of pride, and we think too highly of ourselves individually. And we're taught to do that a lot of times. And with that, we think, well, I know better than everyone else, or I know better than the former standards. And so we've got people who think that they know better than God. And when they do that, then they're going to do whatever they want to do. And ultimately, a lot of times it sounds more fun. Although when you start to look at the results, in our nation, we've got an epidemic of sexually transmitted diseases. We've got an absolute epidemic of abortions and all the trauma that comes from that. We've got broken marriages, broken homes. We've got all kinds of just destruction that really stems from that idea of doing whatever you want. And ultimately, there is going to come a point too when we do have to pay back our finances. And so even economically, we have that problem too.
Right. We have to pay the piper. So everything that you've said is so on point and so important. The 5 steps to kill a nation and how to stop the bleeding. So my question to you is, how do we get back to God? How do we bring people back to the church? You have a lot of the mega churches that are out there, big churches. And I might want to look down on big churches, but a lot of them are preaching this prosperity ministry. Yes, God wants us to prosper and have good success. But the soul, the human soul, the frailty of it, how do we heal the soul? Because a lot of people, I think, are out there looking for something. There are a lot of questions that are out there. And prosperity ministry will only get you so far, at all, anywhere, spiritually. So how do we get back to the basics? How do we get people to believe again and to trust God and to turn from their wicked ways and to just understand and accept Him? How do we get back there?
Yeah, thank you for that question. And I'm going to give 2 simple answers. And just because they're simple doesn't mean that they're easy. And I think that's one of the important things that we have to remember, because it's not brain surgery here, but it is one of those things of it is a simple answer. The first one is we do need a revival of the gospel. We do need to go, and those of us who are Christians, we do need to start sharing the gospel again. Very few Christians share the gospel statistically, and we need to share that Jesus Christ died for our sins, that He was buried, and that He rose again on the third day. And whoever believes in Him shall be saved. We have to get out and proclaim that message to others. That really is where it starts, especially as Christians. The second thing is, and this one's very simple, but it's very difficult, and that is we have to become self-governed again. We need to start taking individual responsibility. A guy who's not necessarily a Christian, maybe he is becoming a Christian or has recently become a Christian, is Jordan Peterson. Perhaps I'm not totally sure. He's he seems to be having some existential crisis there with his faith in a good way, is what I would say. But Jordan Peterson really does hit on this idea, and it does have it right in the sense of we do need that personal responsibility. And that is important, and that is self-governance. You know, God didn't just create one government, the civil government. He created four governments, and that's the civil government, the family government, the church government, and the self-government. And really, the three, civil, church, and family, all work to create good self-government. But when we see those three decaying, we need to go and have personal responsibility to go and to have self-government to kind of restore those other three governments. We need people to step up and really take it on the chin and be disciplined. It's a lot more difficult to be disciplined in our spending financially than it is to be loosey-goosey with their spending and then to get into financial ruin. But both financial ruin and financial discipline are both end up being difficult.
But so many people are so disenfranchised with the church. How do we get them there? How do we bring them in and keep them? Because, I mean, we're talking it, but like you said, the Christians, we've got to go out there and we've got to pronounce who Jesus Christ is. But once we've done it, how do we keep them there with everything that's going around and people feel as if though there's no hope? They're lost because all they hear is 24/7 news, doom and gloom, doom and gloom. And when they're not looking at the doom and gloom, they're listening to these entertainers whom they've made, as we shared in the earlier segment, they've made their gods and their idols. How do we, it seems as if we're competing against that. How are we able to get ahead of it? What do we do? Like, the answer might be simple, but how do we get there?
Yeah, the answer, I believe, is simple, but it's rooted in a deep problem within the church, especially in America. That's really overtaken us. And that problem is pietism. And pietism is a privatization of Christianity. And this really took place in Germany, actually, in the late 1700s and early 1800s is when it became popularized. And of course, that ended up actually leading to, we think of, Germany, the place of the Reformation. How in the world could Nazism come out of Germany? Well, it came there through pietism. And in fact, I believe it was in the 90 percentile that people identified as Christians in Germany. And yet the Nazis still took place. Well, they privatized their Christianity. They kept their Christianity within the church walls. And of course, we should have churches and we should have church walls. I'm not against that when I'm saying this. But what I'm saying is that we need to remember that our Christianity, what's in God's word, is applicable to all life and godliness. And so we need to go out and proclaim that in every area of our life. You know, we're told separation of church and state. Don't bring your religion into politics. That's probably the biggest one. But what about your coworker who's struggling in his marriage, and he comes and brings it up to you? Well, are you going to just, you know, sit out there and say, oh man, that's rough? Or are you going to actually go and invest the word of God into that person? Now, of course, an empty bucket can't pour out water. And so first, where it starts with, again, is that self-discipline and that self-governance, that we have to be disciplined and governed in our own personal walk with God. And so we need to be in the word. We need to be praying, but we need to be living that out in every area of our life. We need to quit being Christians just on Sunday, and we need to be Christians everywhere, everywhere that we are.
I agree. Christians everywhere that we are, and not just on Sunday. So, Pastor, let me ask you this. Is there hope for the world? Is there hope for America? Is there hope for our government?
You know, I do believe there's hope, but the hope is tied directly to repentance and turning back to God. It's directly tied to that step one, as you guys have mentioned several times now, that it's all, the other steps are connected back to step one, forgetting God. We have to remember God. And I believe probably the biggest thing that could happen, well, there's two ways that it could happen. One would be kind of a grassroots revival, which would be the best case scenario, in where we see just a sweeping revival. The other one would be where there'd be great hope, is if we do get a really strong leader who goes and he points to the God of the Bible. And maybe that's, I don't know which one's more likely or more possible, but I think that's where our hope has to be in, is remembering God, because ultimately, even if we get the other four steps right, I don't think that those four steps are going to be sustainable without the foundation of step number one.
Right. So there is hope. So we shouldn't despair.
Absolutely.
Pastor Jones, how often do you talk to your church about the pop culture? We see a lot of glamorizing of Satan, perversion, and violence with this Nas X and his Satan song and Satan shoes, Cardi B with her WAP songs. What are your thoughts on all this going on in our society today?
Yeah, my thoughts definitely are that it's sad, but it shows a lot of the seeds that we've sown right now we're reaping the fruit of it. You know, you take God out of things, and of course, wickedness and perversion and evil is what's going to be the fruit of it. I talk every week, every chance I get up before the pulpit, behind the pulpit, speak to what's going on, and it comes up in the text, and it's so clear when you start to go and to look at it. I mean, we think about the Satan shoes specifically. You know, there's what, 666 of them that were made with a drop of human blood in it. And people didn't go crazy. I mean, they sold out immediately. I mean, it should have just absolutely sickened us. It should have, gone and just, you know, made us flabbergasted. And it's not just that, but it is also, the exaltation of Satan. When you go and you look at that, I mean, this is really scary times that we're looking at. It shows that we're in a spiritual war, not just a physical one or one that's attached to this world, but actually a spiritual war that's going on. And I mean, it's just one of those things where you look at the culture and you go, we have to get back to God's word. But yeah, constantly is how I would answer that. Every chance I get, talking to our congregation about culture and the different things that are going on.
Should Christians participate in politics?
Absolutely. That's a great question. So politics, that word actually means the affairs of the people. And every Christian knows, we're called to love our neighbor. And I believe it's absolutely impossible to love your neighbor without being involved in the affairs of their life. And so the simple answer is not only should Christians be in politics, but I believe that Jesus Christ commands us to be involved in politics when he goes and he says, love your neighbor as yourself.
There you have it, folks. Pastor Sam Jones, author of Five Steps to Kill a Nation and How to Stop the Bleeding. He's a pastor of Faith Baptist Church in Ohio. And what are your services? What are the days that you have services?
Yes, so we've got a Sunday morning service. We've got Sunday school right now. We're going through the Humanist Manifesto number 2. We're probably going to end up going through the different cults and Islam next. But we've got that at 9:30, and then our normal service is at 10:30. And we also have an evening service on Sunday at 6 p.m. And we've got some other things kind of throughout the week, a few Bible studies and different things like that. But that's the main ones there on Sunday.
Pastor Jones, after this COVID-19 lockdown, have you been able to get all the members of your church back?
Yeah, so we took a little bit of a different approach. As I mentioned before, we believe that God has given four different governments. And so when the civil government came and said to shut down, we believe that the civil government doesn't have any bearing in ecclesiastical government and ecclesiastical decisions. So we never shut down. We were very careful and took some precautions because nobody knew what was going on in the when it first started. And so I did ask and make it clear to some of our older and more at risk congregants to stay home if they didn't feel comfortable. But we've had everybody return, and it's actually seen some growth since.
Then another question: the young people at your church, what is the population like? Do you find it difficult to get young people to come to church?
When it comes to young people, we've actually, percentage wise been actually fairly high on young people. I think it definitely helps. I'm probably considered by a lot of people as a young person. I'm 28, going to be 29 here, in later this month. But I've got to remember what month we're in. But that is, I think, really helped to go into have people, the young people. The other thing with young people, you know, Gen X is really about a show, and that's why the seeker sensitive movement really worked. The millennials are a lot more about building relationships. And so they're not necessarily, you know, we're in a small town, so they're not afraid necessarily of smaller communities and to actually have that real sense of community. And so that has been something that we've really tried to build upon and had some good success with.
Do you find that you have to do something different in order to attract them and to keep them there? Because as we all know that the younger generation, they're their future church. And if you're able to establish that foundation, it will stay with them. So what exactly do you find that you have to do, if anything, to keep this generation, to keep the young people coming, other than the fact, like you said, that you are a younger pastor? But so what do you do, if anything, to keep them there?
Yeah, so I think the biggest thing is relationship maintenance. That's probably one of the bigger things. You don't have to do as much relationship maintenance with some of the older generations. Now, of course, I mean, when you get to the oldest generation and things like that, and end of life, that's a little bit of a different story. But with the younger generation, really what they've been craving, because they live in such a virtual world and reality, is they actually, whether or not they can express it, they crave that interpersonal relationship. And so the biggest thing that I see with keeping that younger generation is really winning them one by one, sitting down with them, talking with them, and investing with them and staying current with them and really being relationally driven. That's where I think that we can really capture the younger generation. It's a lot of work, but it's definitely going to be worth it.
And then those that are torn between what we call the outer world versus the world of sanctity, what is your message to them? The ones that are like challenged as to, do I do this? Do I do that? I mean, they seem to be having more fun here in the secular world, whereas here, you know, things seem kind of boring. What is your message to them?
Yeah, I mean, when you start living your Christian life on a daily basis, I can tell you it gets really exciting. I mean, it's exciting when you're standing outside of Planned Parenthood praying and somebody drives by and cusses at you. I mean, that's exciting. You don't get that most places. You know, when you go out and you hold a prayer meeting in a park, that the next day they're going to have Pride Fest come in and you have to have the cops there just to hold a prayer meeting because you had death threats. I mean, it's exciting. I can tell you right now, the secular life is the boring life.
If you'd like to pick up Pastor Samuel Jones' book, head over to gatekeepersonline.com and pick up 5 Steps to Kill a Nation. Thank you to him for joining us tonight. And thank you to everyone who listened to After Dark with Rob and Andrew on America Out Loud. Check out some of the other podcasts and shows on the America Out Loud, like Ladies of Liberty or Talking While Married. You can also find America Out Loud on iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, or just about any audio app. And remember, stand for something or you will fall for nothing.